Hello and welcome back to Pod Upon Parish. I'm John Fagan, the CEO of Scribe and Civicly, and this is episode number 3. Year end is looming, and for a lot of councils, internal audit can feel a bit like a trip to the dentist. But it doesn't have to be like that. Today, I've got Eleanor Green with me, and she is the Chief Accountant at Do The Numbers and Secretary at the Internal Audit Forum. She audits over 200 councils, I believe.
About 90 at any time.
90 at any time. Is that in the same day or same week or same month? What does at any time mean?
So I've got 97 on my calendar this year.
Good, good. So you must be like, how many can you do in a day or week? What's your kind of...
The most I do in a day is 5.
Most I do in a day is 5. Okay, so that's... But that's not physical, that's remote, is it?
No, that's driving to different bits of the New Forest, going house to house to house.
Oh, yeah,
house.
So you cluster them all up.
I cluster them. I'm very, very strongly of the view that a remote audit doesn't meet the requirements because you cannot see the physical minute book, you can't see the physical records, and also you can't see the real body language of the clerk when you ask a question.
Yes,
so I'm pretty strong on, there are some councils that I audit remotely, but they are all ones I've done face-to-face in the past.
Yeah, so you have a relationship there. So,
yeah.
I mean, we're recording this just as 2026 JPAG guide has been, well, there's a big update.
Yes.
Is it something people need to worry about right now? I mean, no. Given that we're approaching...
No, because the guide that is about to come out and will probably be out next week only becomes compulsory for the next financial year. So the one that is compulsory at the moment for the year ends we're about to do is the one that came out last March. Mm-hmm. So it's a good idea to be aware of what's happening with the new one and see what the direction of travel is. But you don't have to do what is in the one you haven't seen yet. You have to do what's in the one we've had for nearly a year.
Yeah, cool. So we're going to definitely jump into that one we've had nearly a year. But just briefly, what is coming up? Are you aware of what's coming up?
Yeah. So there will be assertion 10, which was in section 1 last year. So saying this is what's going to be on your agar form. This year, it will be on the agar form and there will be internal audit guidance for it, which we have not seen. I have seen the draft, but nobody has seen the final version. But in fact, So the audit testing of assertion 10 is literally going to be very little more than what is in my slides. Really high level. Has the council done these 4 things? Not much more. Because, of course, we are not the auditors of those pieces of legislation. So in terms of other changes, the really big change in the practitioner's guide is coming for next year, where it's being completely rewritten and in fact divided into 2 different documents, one of which is must and one is this will be helpful.
Cool.
Next year will be another massive change. Yeah, but the whole principle is we are moving away from the lighter touch.
Good. Okay. So lighter touch, a bit more, a bit more strict on requirements.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, you mentioned assertion 10, so that's been, you know, freaking a few people out, I guess.
Yeah.
It's been discussed a lot. There's a few things that are part of that. One is like the email addresses. You know, do you want to tell us more about?
So I think the key thing in the email addresses and what's really important to realise is that any council's actions, messages, emails are subject to a Freedom of Information request by any member of the public. Also, any member of the public could do a subject access request asking for everything about them in the council's files of any sort. If councillors are using their personal email account, then that personal email account, which may have their tennis, their shopping and their grandchildren in it, also falls under Freedom of Information Act. And the ICO has very strong powers. If, on the other hand, the councillors are using an email account that is linked to the council's website, the proper officer, the clerk, although they may not know about it, can get into a thing called the cPanel, which is round the back of the website, that lets them answer a Freedom of Information request directly from the web stored emails without having to see the councillor's phone. That's got to be a good thing. Also, if councillors are using a council email address and they cease being a councillor, you can just switch the email off. So you don't have the issue of former councillors pretending to be councillors. So it's about protecting councils, frankly, protecting them
Yeah,
from
and
fraud.
individual protected
It's
councils and
protecting the
individuals.
councils. It's protecting the individuals. So I understand why people are going, "Oh, we don't want to." Well, you don't want to be on the receiving end of an ICO investigation. Trust me, you
Yeah,
really,
and you're
really
diving
don't.
into your own personal email
Look,
there where it's
there
mixed
is
in with what,
literally the case where the councillor had the ICO didn't like what he'd said. They thought he was lying, and they seized his laptop for forensic investigation, and they kept it for a year.
Yeah, exactly.
I
But
mean,
what about
can
like
you imagine?
what about
It's
like I get clearly separating also, I think where some councils get confused is like an email account versus a device. So like some councils are wondering, should they get devices, their own mobile devices for their councils or their staff? And like that's the point you make. You know, it's not really, it's not about the device, it's about the centralized control of the email account. And if you've got centralized control to access those emails or remove access to those emails, then you know the person on their mobile device, they won't have access to those emails anymore. So you should
Exactly.
remove the,
Yeah. So
don't have to worry about that.
it's about bringing the management of the emails into the control of the council. And also in the conversation came up about the idea of the clerk having a phone that belongs to the council. We had a situation where a clerk resigned very suddenly in a very bad mood, and to pay the wages, the bank codes went to her personal phone, and she
Yeah.
wouldn't pass them back to the council. So the council could not pay the wages. That risk is worth an awful lot more than buying a refurb phone and a £10 pay as you go SIM. It
Exactly.
really
And
is.
you're just receiving, yeah, like a two-factor. I mean, you don't even need, I would say sometimes even need a SIM card. But it depends how you want to receive your two-factor authentication codes. It could be via email, but yeah, I mean it's a, that's actually a pain in lot in normal companies where you've got this account and you know. Like for me, all the SMSs come to my phone, so it's a team member's pinging.
Yeah. Well,
What about
and I
yeah?
mean, and just to pick up on it, we've got there are a couple of councils who have gone down the refurb phone pay-as-you-go SIM that's normally attached to the office Wi-Fi, but of course people can send it a text message because it has a SIM. So anyone can send a text message with, "Did you know this road is flooded?" And I think the £10 top-up lasted the clerk nearly a year. So it's and for resilience and safety and security. It's a no-brainer. And as an audit test, is the council taking good care of public money? There's your test.
Yes, I mean we on previous podcast with Mark Aubergine, we covered a lot of assertion 10 on that point, so I won't dwell on it too much
Yeah.
further. Yeah, moving on. So you meant, I mean, you have mentioned in the webinar that your governance is often where councils trip up, you know, more than the actual math. So what are the common paperwork pitfalls that you've discovered in
So
your?
one of the really key ones is a lot of councils will only publish part of the internal audit report. They'll maybe publish the governance statement and the accounting statement. They don't publish the internal audit page. As of, I can't, I think it's actually going to be in for this year because it was in last year. You've got to publish the whole of the AGAR, including the internal audit page. And if you've had an internal audit report, what will definitely be in the new PG practitioner's guide. And is always been good practice is that your auditor should be giving you a report of the things that are to be improved. And you need to minute that the council has seen that and that the council has agreed an action plan to correct anything the auditor has spotted. And I would say, from having talked from my experience of talking to a lot of other auditors, if your auditor says there's nothing to improve, they have not done a thorough job because I'm yet to meet the council that is 100% compliant. Mainly because the rules keep changing. So, unless the council is as sad about reading the practitioner's guide as I am, they will be behind on something. It's just the way of it. And of course, there are always ICO rulings or employment tribunal rulings that can just tweak things. So, you need to be up to date. And having an audit, having an action plan for the audit report is key. It needs to be minuted at full council. The other one that has been a requirement for several years is the annual approval of the independence and competence of the auditor. And it's a good idea that the councillors actually know who the auditor is. I find it, I go to an event and I say to a councillor, "Do you know who your auditor is?" And they go, "No, I've got no clue." And I say, "Well, actually, it's me or it's Tim."
Oh,
Or,
really?
"Oh,
Yeah.
yeah." They'll stand in, they will literally stand in front of me and go, haven't got a clue. I said, well,
Well, what
actually, I've
about
got.
like if your account's also like you've got know someone who's got kind of auditing, who's a bit of an audit geek, not officially an auditor, but and you don't want to pay for an official audit and you could just get them to do it. Is that acceptable?
It is, but you'll still need to have an engagement letter to show that they understand which law they're working under. Because, of course, there's a big difference between company law, which is what we all study when we take our accountancy qualifications, or county council law, which they do when they study CIPFA, or management accounts when they study CIMA. Very few accountancy qualifications cover charities, and I can promise you not a single one covers parish law. So, unless that accountant can prove that they understand the law that the agar comes under, which is pretty unlikely, it's it and they are I mean the new requirement is going to be that there is an engagement letter from every auditor, even a free one, an audit plan from every auditor, even a free one, and an action plan from the council, even if it's a free one. Well, if people are going to do that for nothing, how are they independent of the council if they don't think their work is worth being charged for? That would be my question. Because you, if you don't have a contract of any sort, you have no comeback if they, for instance, just don't actually sign the agar.
Yeah, exactly. There's all kind. I mean, yeah.
You've got no comeback. And also, this is not the council's money; it's the public's money. This is the key thing. What reassurance would a random person moving into the village have if they know that it's a mate of the chairman who's done it for free?
Exactly.
Yeah,
Yeah, you wouldn't trust it either.
I mean, I don't, I and as I've often said, I even charge my mother for a tax return, because it means that she's covered by my PII. Now, parish
Yeah.
auditors don't have to have PII, but we do have to have an engagement letter, no matter how small the council. So.
I'm actually going to circle back on the Assertion 10 because, yeah, also during the webinar back afterwards regarding web accessibility, and you did some of the things you did say relaxed a few clerks, let's say,
Yes.
because they were quite stressed about that, particularly related to cost. But yeah, do you want to talk a bit more about that?
So the web accessibility rules are not new. They came in 2018, and they are quite onerous, but they are about making your website accessible to all of your users. Now, for most councils, when it started, it was just the simple put an accessibility statement on your homepage. Since Assertion 10 came out, there have been certain providers, unspecified origin, who've been telling councils that they have to have an absolutely full bells and whistles website. But that actually directly contradicts the government website that says that it's proportionate to the size of the body, the public body, and that the smallest bodies do not have to comply with every single part of it if it is a disproportionate burden. Parish councils, by definition, are the smallest bodies. The smallest other public bodies are primary schools. The smallest primary school has a budget of about 200,000. That makes the smallest primary school bigger than 90% of parish councils. So we are the people that the proportionality page is aimed at. And it says your accessibility needs to be proportionate. So you have to have an accessibility statement on your homepage, which says, we've done everything as accessible as we can. If you can't access it, ask us and we will provide it in the format you want. Job done. Because if you spend hundreds of pounds doing all sorts of bells and whistles on a website that your annual web hits are less than 50, that is not good use of public money. I'm sorry, but it's just not. And, if in a bigger council, say with a venue hire, they may well have bookings that need to be accessible to people with screen readers or different colours. But if you do your hall bookings through a corporate product like Hallmaster, it's compliant. So therefore, you are compliant. Whereas the back page of your financial regulations, seriously, how many people are actually reading that other than people like me? So it's as John brilliantly said to me at a session, if you have a fully accessible meeting room on the ground floor, don't put in a stairlift. Use what you've got and use it well. But for the smallest public bodies, there is a government website page that clearly says that the implementation of that is proportionate. At the other end of it, internal auditors are not the enforcement body for the web accessibility regulations. The EHRC are. And if you go to the
Who are the
relevant
EHRC?
Equality and Human Rights Commission, so the people who
Okay.
also do the Equality Act, and they are the statutory regulator, but a bit like the ICO with Freedom of Information Act, they only react to complaints. They do not come looking at your website.
Yeah, they don't audit
No, they do. They
proactively
have
audit. Yeah.
no right to audit. Yeah, they don't have the right to come and audit. They don't have the resources to come and audit. They will only react to a complaint. And as with the ICO, their reaction to a complaint when they get one will be, could you sort out this little tiny bit? They're not going to make you do everything. They just want to make that complaint go away. If you look at most ICO rulings, it's could you make sure you don't do that bit again? Not you have to do everything. So it has made me quite cross that certain providers have been telling clerks they've got to spend a lot of money, taxpayers' money, to do something that is not delivering services. And I will push back very hard against it with the .gov.uk link.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean actually, yeah, good. So yeah, one of the things you there's a phrase everyone remembered from your webinar. You said the Daily Mail test. What can you yeah, what
So the
thing?
Daily Mail test is, it comes out of a couple of, putting a clerk in prison is where it actually came from. If the cat, when you're trying to think, are we doing the right thing, especially if it's not quite a standard action? If the Daily Mail had a journalist in your meeting, would they write a story about what you are doing? If they wouldn't, you are probably doing something right. If they come in and they're scribbling away, going, oh, we've got a headline, you've cocked up. There's no other way around it. And I have seen council meetings, the famous Jackie Weaver meeting. Those councillors should have sat there and thought, hang on, our locum clerk has just renamed herself Britney Spears. This is not going well. So you need to think, would a tabloid write a story about what we are doing? I have seen councils doing stuff that is almost certainly not lawful, but because it was for the benefit of the community, and when the local press got hold of it, everybody went, yeah, that was a good thing, even though it wasn't lawful, then you go ahead with it, because there are times when you have to say this is the greater good.
Excellent. Thanks, Eleanor. So we're just going to sort of wrap things up right now on this particular topic. So if there's someone only remembers one thing from this episode, what should it be? What should they take away from today?
To read Section 4 of the Practitioner's Guide. I can't say it often enough. It's only about 10 pages of font 12. You can be downloaded from the SAAA website, but it has the answers, it has the guidance. Please read it. Please read it every year. Please reread it until you know your way around it by heart, because it is where the answers to most of your problems and questions are.
Is it easy read or is
Yes.
it not
Yes,
too
we
technical?
made
It
it.
was cleaned up, wasn't it?
It
Yeah.
we so when it was rewritten and Section 5 was rewritten, it was written to be dipped into and dipped out of. So a lot of people's fears about it are actually unfounded. If they turn straight to Section 4 or Section 5 and start reading, it flows through, and it was written to be not scary. That's the intention, but it's there. And if it isn't giving you what you need, please give us feedback, because then we can make it better. But almost all the queries that come up, the answers are in there.
Cool. Excellent. So we'll take that away. I've never read it. I should read it. I should have actually done a bit of the intro stuff at the beginning. We jumped straight into internal auditing, and I normally like to get to know the guests just before we do that. I mean, you are the famous chief accountant that do the numbers, the LTD. You're based down in Wiltshire, Somerset, aren't you?
I'm Southampton. I live in
Oh,
Southampton.
Southampton. Oh, yeah, good. And you're also secretary of the internal audit forum. Yeah, so how did you, so have you always been a, how did you get into it? Have you always been an internal auditor? And do you have other parts of your role?
I fell into accountancy. I left university determined never to work in an office, and then became an accountant. So I got that one wrong. And then I was working in commerce and needed to change jobs in a hurry, and found myself temping for the Audit Commission. doing parish audits under the old system,
Okay.
and then took time out to have children. And then in 2001 was contacted by the audit commission saying, there's this new thing called an agar form. Would you like to work with it? And so I've sort of never quite escaped since. But in as well as doing parishes, I have a tax and charity practice the rest of the year.
So what
So I
percentage of your work is split between tax charities and local
it's
council?
about 40% parishes, 40% tax, 20% charities.
Okay. Well, you mentioned about like not wanting to work in an office. So I'm actually going to ask you another question. Yeah, so going back to you're in an office, well, you're pretty much in an office these days. Go back to your 18-year-old self. If you could go back to that person, well, firstly, where is that person? What are they doing? And if you could give that person some advice, sit next to them, what would advice would you give that 18-year-old Eleanor?
Probably spend less time in the Union Bar at Southampton University and get a slightly better degree grade.
Dare I ask, what degree grade did you
I
get?
got a third. I got
You
an
got
honours,
a
but
third.
I got a third. Yep,
Oh
yep.
my God, Eleanor got a third.
Then
That's
again, my ACCA accountancy exams, my finals, I absolutely scraped them, but I could have scraped them even finer. So that was again because I could have spent another night in the pub. So there we go.
okay. So you like going down the pub. Yeah, is there one thing people don't know? I mean, we all know you're we all think we know you quite well. Is there one thing that, that you could share a secret about yourself that we're not aware of?
I am the treasurer of the Southampton Mineral and Fossil Society, and I run the Hampshire Mineral Show every September. There
Okay.
you go.
How popular is that?
We have about 40 stall holders, and we have a couple of hundred people come in the door. We take over a secondary school and fill it with minerals and fossils, and then also we run meetings every month, and talk about rocks.
So you have a good collection, do you? Or
Yeah,
so you have a special
both.
room or shelf or
We have a wall in our dining room that was built to take the rock collection. Yeah, we're both
okay.
rather obsessed.
Oh, awesome. And what's your prized rock?
Probably one of the, well, probably either a dinosaur egg or one of the fossil dinosaurs.
Okay, and where did you find that?
So they were both bought.
Oh, okay, cool.
They were bought online. One of the best things we've found was a what's called a Clavithes shell. It's like a giant whelk, and it's bigger than my hand. And we found it on the beach at Barton in Dorset, and I found it jammed in the mud, and I just saw the very tip of it, and it's bigger than my hand. So I'm quite proud of that one.
Awesome. It's yeah, yeah, Dorset would be a good spot, I guess. Yeah, for finds. So we do have this tradition of the last guest leaving a question for the next guest. So I will ask you to drop a question for the next guest, but before you do that, you've got to answer the question from Nigel Hayes, the RFO at Dorchester Town Council. So yeah, I like this question. He says, who or what has been the biggest influence in your career and why?
Not so much my career, but the whole way I've approached life was my grandmother, who was also called Eleanor, and she basically campaigned for governance, transparency, and accountability. She actually ran the first ever community payback scheme in the world in the 70s. And then in her 80s, she picked a fight with Rupert Murdoch and cost him £11 million.
Oh
And
yeah, example. Oh.
she stopped him being able to build a multiplex by going out every night with her other 80-year-old friends and moving the setting out pegs until he gave up. And I want to be like her when I'm 80. So there we go.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, my dad's 84. He still works full time. I want to be like him as well. Well, I don't know if I want to be working
Possibly not
full time.
full time.
Yeah. Anyway. So, yeah, do you, I mean, yeah, do you have a question for your next
So my
guest?
question to the next person is, if you won the lottery and didn't have to work, would you carry on working at all?
Oh, I love that. That is a great one. Awesome. Excellent. Well, thanks for having a chat with me today, Eleanor. I'm not like the most professional podcast host, but I'm going to start getting better and better at it. This is the third one. But yeah, really appreciate you coming along today to have a chat. And yeah, we'll be sharing. We haven't published the podcast yet, but we'll be dropping like the last three, and then we'll see if anyone likes them.
Brilliant.
Take
Well,
it
I can
easy.
tell you're not a professional podcast host because you're much shorter and to the point than many of them.
Good. Okay. I just.